Now, it is my privilege to introduce our moderator for the night, who is Michael Korn. Michael is a very popular TV show host. He's an author and a public speaker. So he hosts the Michael Korn Show on CTS. He co-hosts Two Bald Guys every weekday. And Michael is also the author of the best-selling books. There's 12 of them. I don't have the titles. Which are published in several countries in several different languages, okay? So this guy's cool. He's also received many honorary doctorates and awards for his writing. So now, without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to Michael. So please welcome Michael Korn, guys.
Did he say I was very cool?
Yeah. I just want to check. I have a funny accent. Well, actually, you have a funny accent. Problem is, so does Joe. I just want to make sure you can all hear us. The acoustics here are not perfect. You can pick all this up, generally? You okay? Over there? Over there? Yeah. Someone said what? That's not funny. And it's illogical as well. I've just been told the event is cancelled. There are many students here. You don't seem to understand. You should be out drinking, taking drugs, and being... Shut up. Whatever you believe, or don't believe, and whatever you believe or don't believe at the end of the evening, and I'm not just saying this to get a cheap round of applause, at a time in history where censorship is increasingly fashionable, it is a real tribute to the organizers and to you that we have a debate in a university in Canada. Well done. Nothing will run to time. Don't worry about that. It happens. I'll try to be as completely fair as I can be. I am totally objective. The evening will be structured, well, as we go along. I won't tell you all of the details now. It's too boring. But each person will have plenty of time. There'll be questions afterwards. There'll be an intermission a bit later. And let me introduce the speakers tonight. It says here, DiCarlo and Boot. It sounds like a shoe salesman. I said, DiCarlo and Boot. DiCarlo and Boot have debated this particular subject from their respective views at universities across Ontario and around the world, even at Oxford and Virginia Tech. They have nothing in common, believe me. They've also debated on my TV show, which is superb. But this will be the first time for Oshawa's campus. In the past, this topic has been debated by several speakers and brought great discussion, disagreement, violence, love, fighting, whatever, between students. Christopher DiCarlo is a professor here. Come on, a round of applause. Yeah. To get a good mark on their paper. Look at that. Look at that. Christopher DiCarlo, professor here, philosopher of science and ethics. He was voted Canada's Humanist of the Year. You know, there is so much room for a cheap joke at that point, but I'm not going to make it. Canada's Humanist of the Year, and this is very impressive, Ontario's best lecturer. For 2008. Very good. He has written a number of books, papers, scholarly articles, and is a highly requested speaker for a variety of lectures and TV shows and debates. He and his wife, Lindy, live in Lingua. their two boys, Jeremy and Matt. The Reverend Joe Boot is an apologist. Yes, come on. I do hope there is no one who believes an apologist is a guy who goes around saying sorry. You know that. He's an apologist, educator, author. He serves with Ravi Zacharias Ministries. Ravi Zacharias, a quite brilliant man. For 7 years in the UK and Canada, working for 5 years as the Canadian director for Ravi Zacharias Ministries, and continues to serve as an adjunct apologist for them. He's a worldwide speaker, has spoken in over 20 countries in numerous universities, seminaries, churches, colleges, conferences, and has publicly debated leading atheists in many North American settings. He currently lives in Toronto with his wife Jenny and 3 children, Naomi, Hannah, and Isaac. He's church planting and launching the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity, and my oldest daughter thinks he looks a bit like Johnny Depp. Oh, he's going to hate me for saying that. The debate will last approximately 2 hours. We'll start off with each speaker having half an hour to present their views, their thesis. After each speaker has presented their points, they will then have 10 minutes each to respond to each other. Then there'll be a 10-minute intermission. It'll be more like 15 or 20, I know that. There'll be an opportunity for guests to come up to the microphone and ask questions to each of the speakers. There will be a time allotted for 6 questions, 3 to each speaker. And after the question and answer period, each speaker will be given 5 minutes to give their closing remarks. Oh my golly. There. T-H-E-R-E. Universities ain't what they were. 5 minutes to give their closing remarks, and then the debate will be over. The debate will be over here, but you will debate for hours and days and weeks in the pub and everywhere else, and that's how it should be. They apparently tossed a coin, they gambled, which is probably very sinful, and I'm a Catholic, we can do anything. And I think Joe Boot won or lost, so Joe, you're going first. Sir, you have half an hour from around now. It's great to be here. First, let me thank Josh and the organizing committee and Michael for moderating and Christopher for... Another sign. Right. Stop the clock. Can you start it again, Michael? Great. I want to thank Christopher as well for participating in this with me. We have spoken many times before, and I consider Christopher a friend. Now, I want to start by saying my only motivation for being here this evening is not publicity. It's not out of a desire to get my face on the university newspaper. I don't especially like debates very much. There are easier ways to make a living, I assure you. I'm only here because I believe that this issue is absolutely critical and fundamental to all of our lives, not just this life, but also the next. And therefore, that's my sole motivation for being here, out of a concern for this issue and for others. The question before us today is, does God exist, or at least is it rational and reasonable for us to believe that God exists? And I want to note it's important to remember we're not asking tonight whether you like God, or whether Christopher likes God, or whether we've got autobiographical commentary on what God has or has not done for us, or what we feel he should have done for us, or he hasn't done for us. The question is
God necessary to make our lives intelligible? Now, I must start by being honest. I'm a Christian. I can't hide from that. I can't pretend I come to this subject in a neutral fashion. For the simple reason that neutrality in reasoning is impossible. We all come to this issue with pre-commitments. And my argument today essentially is that God is a necessary precondition for the intelligibility of our experience. The fact that there are non-theists here who are involved in this debate and are listening to this debate, are participating in it, to my mind, already presupposes that God is, and that without God, our lives are reduced to the absurd. Now, that's not to say that non-theists can't be rational or can't be moral. It's simply to say that my position tonight is that a non-theist being rational or being moral is contradictory to the extent that they are borrowing from my worldview. The non-theist must borrow from the theist's worldview in order to have rationality and morality. In other words, I hold that the non-theist is intellectually schizophrenic. They want to have their cake and eat it. They want a rational world, and they want to do reasoning and logic and debates and be moral, but they don't want the only person who can ground those things, which is God. Now, we should all know that strict atheism is impossible. It's impossible because God might exist in a sphere beyond your immediate experience, beyond your immediate personal contact. Only an omnipresent person could know that God did not exist. And since only God is omnipresent, only God could know that God did not exist. That is why my opponent today normally identifies himself, unless you've changed recently, Christopher, is as an ag-theist. An ag-theist. Now, it's important to ask at the outset, what type of evidence is relevant to this question? We don't use the same sorts of evidence to answer all different types of questions. It depends on the thing we're investigating or exploring. Depending on what philosophers call the ontological status of those things. For example, in one case of a countryman of mine, Richard Dawkins, who I'm sure is known to you, he thinks that believing in God is like believing in orbiting teapots or pink elephants. Now, some people think that asking the question, does God exist, is like saying, are there cookies in the jar? Well, let's all go and have a look and see if there are cookies in the jar. But this is a completely different kind of question to are there cookies in the jar questions. For example, I don't determine tonight whether Dr. DiCarlo's arguments are rational by going over there and splitting his head open with an axe, looking at his brain and saying, is this a rational brain? Because whether something is rational or not is not determined by an empirical physical inspection of the human brain. I hope he doesn't take offense of that. In the same way, I don't decide whether a piece of music is beautiful by putting a CD under a microscope and saying, can I quantify or qualify whether this music is beautiful by a microscopic inspection? If I want to discover the true nature of number, and there have been very different views of number, I don't collect all the fridge magnet numbers I possibly can from around the world and then identify their properties and say, now I can describe numbers. It's a very different type of question, and different types of argument are required. In the nature of the case, if God exists, he is the source of all rationality because he's the creator, the sustainer, and the governor of all things. So being irritated you don't find God in the physical universe is like being cross because when you open a play by William Shakespeare like Hamlet, William Shakespeare doesn't fall out the center of the book. Of course you don't find William Shakespeare in the middle of his play, Hamlet. Furthermore, God is nothing like an orbiting teapot or a pink elephant. For a start off, I can look through a telescope and see whether there is an orbiting teapot. It's just one more thing in the physical universe. If God is, he is not one more thing in the physical universe. He is back of everything. So the critical question to ask is, what must be true about reality and God to allow our experience as human beings to be what it appears to be? Now, I want to suggest to you tonight that all of you have a divinity concept. All of you believe in a divinity concept of some kind. What do we mean by the divine? Well, we mean something that is non-dependent, incontingent, unconditioned. Now, for some people, that independent entity or reality is energy or matter, some sort of non-dependent reality. For me, as a Christian, that non-dependent reality is God. Now, the pagans believed in many gods, but that wasn't really their divinity concept, because they believed that the gods themselves evolved from some sort of primeval, watery chaos. So actually, their concept of the divine was a naturalistic one. Now, we all hold, each of us, come to this tonight, all holding certain beliefs by which we seek to interpret the world. It's like a set of lenses. You believe certain things to view the world, to understand the world. Now, our most basic or our most foundational beliefs cannot be proven directly. If they were, if they could be, they wouldn't be your most basic foundational beliefs. The thing you establish them with would be your most basic foundational belief. If I said to you, God exists, and here's how I'm going to show directly God exists because of the following evidences, God wouldn't be my most foundational belief, would he? I believe that the universe is unintelligible without him. You cannot prove directly the existence of other minds, the existence of the material universe, the reliability of our memories. There are no successful philosophical arguments that show or prove that there are other minds. You might be a figment of my imagination, an aspect of my experience. If our ultimate foundation or starting point hasn't been decided upon tonight, the choice is very simple. Our ultimate foundation and starting point in our thinking is either God or it's the finite self. It is the I. Now, very quickly, there was a Scottish empiricist philosopher called David Hume, and he argued that all we have are sense perceptions. That's what a human being is, he says, a bundle of sensations. He says, there's no evidence for God, there's no evidence for the material world. Didn't even believe you could prove causality. Indeed, you can't, not directly. Now, this kind of belief is still with us. One of the dominant views during the 20th century in physics was that held by Ernst Mach. And he developed he had a whole following of scientists and philosophers. He's responsible for the Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 3, Mach 4, the speed of sound. He didn't believe that atoms existed. He thought they were useful fictions. And a whole school of philosophers and scientists followed him in that. For Immanuel Kant, who followed, the world was relative to the mind. He followed Hume. And he says, we don't know things in themselves as they really are out there. We don't know what the world really is. We only know how it appears to us. But he tried to come up with a way of rationalizing the world based on enlightenment thinking. So he sought to come up with a necessary set of conditions to know the phenomenal world, the world of our experience, but they were all based on enlightenment rationalism. Euclidean geometry, Newtonian physics, stuff that is now outdated. Honest atheists have seen the implications of this, and they have identified the mood of our time as existentialism. The existentialists have said, like Sartre, we are a bubble on an ocean of nothingness. Nothing can be known. It's a good question is to ask, how does he know nothing can be known? For me as a Christian, on one side of this discussion, I begin with the sovereign God who is foundational to all things, my ultimate foundation. God is the source of all possibility and therefore all true knowledge. The question is, how can you have valid knowledge of anything in a universe not governed by God? That's my question. The basic question of epistemology. Episteme, meaning knowledge, and logos. Theory of knowledge. Is knowledge possible? You might say, well, I know what I know. But philosophers for a long time, skeptics, have pointed out that if you begin with your finite self, say, I'm ultimate, I'm my final point of reference, the I is ultimately all you can know. How do you know anything more than that? The threat is what we call solipsism. That is, if there's no God and it's just your mind, the I, the self, How can you know that anything is real or true outside of your own imagination, your own mind? If man then denies God and makes himself ultimate in the universe, he is unable finally to know anything but himself. He dispenses with God, and when he does, he dispenses with a knowable universe. Today, the majority of philosophers, the majority of the philosophical tradition, would not come out for this debate tonight, because they think debate is pointless. Philosophy has become exhausted by this basic question of how we can know things. Many philosophers will simply not bother coming out to any such debate because they say, well, really, we're just down to pragmatics now. Whatever gives you a sense of control, whatever makes life work for you, do that. We've all heard that, haven't we? If it works for you, do it. Oh, Jesus works for you. I go to the gym. You do Jesus, I do yoga. Because they're thought to be equivalent statements. Because you can't really know. This is what is thought. In other words, we've been imprisoned in meanings rather than meaning. We call it post-modernity. We've given up the idea of accurate description. That is, non-theists have. With an impersonal universe and no God, there is no absolute context. That is, tonight, by what criterion are you going to judge who's right? What is your basis for judgment? By what criterion do you measure how one collection of atoms over here and another collection of atoms over here is right or wrong, what arguments are valid or invalid? Unless you can know about every atom from the birth of the universe to the present in exhaustive detail, you cannot possibly know whether there is truth or meaning. And so today we have a web of beliefs. The modern tradition in Wittgenstein don't even believe there's meaning in words anymore. Basically, the meaning is the use. It's just pointless. Just words. This is just words tonight. All there is are sound vibrations hitting your head. That's all. In your ears. It doesn't mean anything more than that. And so my whole argument today is that my God is necessary to have an intelligible, meaningful world because all facts are derivative. God is the source of all possibility. Original chance destroys the possibility of knowledge, and all meaning becomes a social construct. You have your meaning, I'll have my meaning, he can have his, she can have hers. In fact, honest atheists like Albert Camus have held that we live in an absurd and meaningless world surrounded by a horde of irrationals. The Christian position, however, is that the absolute creator God, or the theistic position, has given us his word, ultimately, in Jesus Christ, and that God knows all facts and is therefore alone able to interpret reality authoritatively. Here's my key argument this evening. There's two views being presented tonight. In anti-theism, we have the basic idea of the brute fact. Let me define that for you. The brute fact. Theists, non-theists, I should say, will not permit that the universe, including you and me, is already structural in nature. There is no essence. You might have being, but there's no essence. Because there is no personal God and no eternal plan. Assume for a moment that Christopher's position is right tonight, that chance is ultimate. There's no plan, no structure, no will, no ultimate purpose. Human beings are of necessity when they come to the world, when they come to look at the world, they are rationalizing it for the first time in a completely original fashion. Think about that. This world has no original plan, no design plan, no purpose, no original meaning. So that when you come to the world, you are in an original way, and for you, rationalizing it for the first time, trying to give it some kind of structure. By definition, this structure can only be for you. Doesn't matter what really Christopher says tonight, the structure that he gives the universe is only for him. Because there's no God, there's no plan, these facts are irrational by definition. They're not previously arranged or related or ordained by God. There's no plan. Clearly, the structure can only be for the individual. In other words, the existentialist tradition is right in holding that what is given to us without God is the non-rational world, and human beings have the burden of trying to rationalize the irrational. What appears to be rationally related is only so because you have so rationalized it. In other words, whatever has not come into contact with the human mind is wholly non-structural or non-rational in character. Now, this is a belief. This is a religious conviction, friends. It is a religious conviction to believe that this world is without original design, plan, and structure, and you are confronted with a horde of irrationals. Consequently, there is no neutral approach to knowledge. We either think in terms of God as the ultimate source, or we invent a meaning for ourselves. This is the problem for the non-theist. How can a brute fact be anything more ever than a brute fact? You see, my worldview, my belief holds that history and nature are governed by God, who ordained and created them in a universe of total meaning, so that Jesus could say, every hair on your head is numbered. Not a sparrow falls to the ground without my Father. Every aspect of your life has a total meaning in terms of the purpose and plan of God. There is a relationship, a pre-established relationship between all facts, and this relationship can be discovered. And that means there is objective meaning. Simply put, all that is known by human beings is already known by God and governed by His providence. Now, I think the history of philosophy reveals very clearly that when you start with the self as ultimate, or the I, that is when you say, I'm not interested in God as a presupposition, I'm interested only in the self, in a universe of brute factuality, true knowledge, sure knowledge, becomes totally impossible. We are confronted by a limitless array of infinite, brute, unknowable, unrelated, totally irrational facts that are impervious to reason, because there is no relationship between them. They've been thrown out of the womb of chance. If I take a zero, an irrational brute fact thrown out of the womb of chance, and you add to it another billion or 10 billion zeros, what have you got? Zero. It doesn't matter how many zeros you take, there is no established relationship between them. You've got one big fat zero. One might insist that we have being and we'll define our own essence. That's the essence of existentialism. But then we have to grant that every other person in the world has the same right. They too have no definition, no essence, no pre-established pattern, no meaning. And so they too have a right to create a universe unto themselves. So if the non-theist was really consistent with what they believe, nothing could be known. And that is why I've said that the non-theist is an intellectual schizophrenic. They borrow from the theistic worldview continuously to support their own arguments. With brute, uncreated, unrelated facticity as ultimate, and the human mind as the final point of reference, all you have is the irrational particulars out there and arbitrary ideas in your mind that you are trying to relate together. What becomes very clear to me is that whenever you start without God, the very idea of proving anything is absurd, because you've already denied the unity of truth and the possibility of truth. Pragmatists and empiricists have asserted a total irrationalism. Put it another way, unless we hold that in God, who is totally self-sufficient and unconditioned, we have fact and design, reason and fact, prior to and before existence and creation, we are only confronted out there with the irrational, unintelligible idea of brute fact thrown up from the womb of chance. The atheist and existentialist Camus put it well. He said this, and I quote, I said that the world is absurd, but I was too hasty. The world in itself is not reasonable, that is all that can be said, but what is absurd is the confrontation of this irrational and the wild longing for clarity whose call echoes in the human heart. The absurd depends as much on man as on the world. For the moment, it is all that links them together. This is all I can clearly discern in this measureless universe where my adventure takes place. Albert Einstein understood this predicament well. Having argued initially that knowledge must start and end with experience, and that propositions derived from logic are empty as regards reality, this is what he said. He said he was confronted with an enigma, and I quote, "How can it be that mathematics, being after all the product of human thought which is independent of experience, is so admirably appropriate to the objects of reality?" In other words, how is it that mathematical equations and relations can bear any resemblance to the world out there? So he said, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that the universe is comprehensible. Why on earth should the universe be comprehensible unless there is a God who relates that world out there to my mind? The schizophrenic nature of anti-theism emerges again and again and again. On the one hand, there's the insistence that sound thinking must regard God as non-existent, or that it's an open question. There's the assumption that you can get along in the universe without God. On the other hand, naive realism says there's order, structure, design, purpose, and everybody operates on that assumption. You don't wait for a bus that isn't timetabled to come. You expect that the present will be like the past. You expect to walk out of here and not shoot upwards into space, but actually remain attached to the ground. You expect uniformity and consistency in your experience, but in a child's world, why should you expect that? You've got no right to expect that without God. Let me reinforce this one more time. The one recourse people might have is to say, in denying God, is that somehow, in a manner impossible to prove, these brute, irrational facts, as they evolved from chaos and chance, accidentally developed patterns in some naturalistic process. Interestingly, Richard Dawkins has recently suggested in Expelled that maybe aliens have left a genetic imprint on our genes. But of course, those aliens themselves must be the result of a naturalistic, undirected chance process. This is nonsense. Maybe there is, then, a universe out there, or maybe there's a multiverse out there, or a vast array of differing patterns, but either way, without God, we can't possibly know. All meanings are just human conventions. They're not objective, they're not absolute in any sense. Because a totally exhaustive knowledge of all facts in the universe at any given moment, of all experience of all events in all of history, from the birth of atoms to the present, is impossible. You can't structure that. With your mind, you can't possibly know that there's pattern meaning in it all. Thus, you can choose your faith tonight. You can ask which one of these views makes sense of your life, one in which you're afloat in a vast ocean of chance, shoreless and bottomless, where no one can know anything as it truly is, or him or herself what they truly are. Or you can accept that God has a total meaning and purpose for reality. Darwin and Freud further developed this, reducing us to our environment and the level of an animal. A primordial urge. Freud said, well, our basic urge as human beings is to eat the father and copulate with the mother. And that's what drives our thinking and our being. Primordial urge, then, is what governs people. You can't have a system of thought in this kind of a universe. System implies an underlying coherence and structure to reality. There are various implications of this. The atheist is finally a prisoner of impersonal blind forces, isolated in a meaningless array of mindless events. The world is desacralized. You might say that this thing differs from that thing. The atomic arrangement of this thing differs from the atomic arrangement of that thing. But you can't make a value judgment between them. You can say this is different from that, but how can you say this is better than that? This is more right than that. This is more true than that. As Jean-Paul Sartre asserted, man is a useless passion. In killing God, you kill yourself. The moral implications of this he saw very readily. Sartre wrote, Dostoevsky said, if God didn't exist, everything would be permissible. And that is the very starting point of existentialism. Indeed, everything is permissible if God does not exist. And as a result, man is forlorn because neither within him nor without does he find anything to cling to. If existence really does precede essence, that is, if existence comes before any kind of structure or pattern. There is no explaining things away by reference to a fixed and given human nature. If God does not exist, we find no values or commands to turn to, which legitimize our conduct. And thus Sartre said, man is a being whose project is to be God. Ethical subjectivism and ethical relativism leave us defining morality as either what you like or don't like, your preferences based on what kind of cheese you ate the night before, or ethics are purely historically relatively determined. If you're in this country at that time or in this country at that time, you'd believe the following about ethics. Any appeals to evolution to try and ground ethics are abortive and hopeless. Philosopher Stephen Evans has rightly noted, the moral order does not consist in any such things as instincts or feelings. It's not an instinct because it is itself the standard by which we judge our instincts to be good or bad. And it is not merely a social impulse or feeling. People who have dulled their consciences often are in fact obligated to do things, yet have no such feelings of obligation whatsoever. Feelings and obligations cannot be identical. If you've got no transcendent moral source, then how can you possibly make a value judgment between a tyrant or justice, oppression, prejudice? The Nazi war criminals justified their pogrom of the Jews based on the law of Germany. They were breaking no law of the land, and they appealed to North American and European eugenics programs to justify their behavior. It's not then objectively evil to abuse little children or to lie and cheat and steal and murder. It's just a preference or it's relativistically defined. What are the implications for morality? Well, there's two types of explanations for reality. We're talking about them. One is personal, the other is impersonal. There's either a personal rational agency behind all things or there isn't. And we believe that God has created the world and our minds in such a way that we can form real rational beliefs because this is a real rational universe. Now let's assume for sake of argument that's incorrect and that the non-theistic position is right. If your whole thinking is the product of impersonal, undirected evolutionary processes, why do you trust your mind at all? Charles Darwin himself asked this question. In a letter on July 3rd, Charles Darwin wrote to W. Graham and said this, and I quote, "With me the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of a man's mind, which has developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the conviction of a monkey's mind if there were any convictions in such a mind? How can you justify rationality then? It's an appeal either downward to brutes and to the void, or you can say, well, I'm going to just have a rational argument for rationality, but then that, of course, is viciously circular. If reason itself is in the dock, how can you justify it purely by a rational argument? The only justification for rationality is a super-rational appeal to God. The same is true of the problem of our minds and of our brains. Do you know, today, if your mind, your brain, is just a random collocation of atoms, as Bertrand Russell put it, then the best way of settling this debate tonight is let's go out and get two cans of Coke. Chris could shake one and I'll shake the other, and whichever can fizzes the most, they win the debate. Because if you're just neurotransmitters and the firing of electrochemical events, the shakedown of atoms in your brain, then there is no basis for validity or invalidity. I hold and I put it to you today that anti-theism destroys the intelligibility of human experience.
Thank you very much. That'll be Diet Coke for me. There is more to come. I wouldn't leave at this point. In fact, lock the doors. Don't let them out. Dr. DiCarlo, 30 minutes to you, sir.
Thank you, Michael. How's everybody doing tonight?
I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here this evening to discuss the issue of God's existence or non-existence. I have to, as I always do in these debates, state from the outset that my purpose here is not to intentionally offend the religious sensitivities of anyone here this evening. I do know how personal and comforting religious beliefs are and can be to some of you, so I've made it a good part of my life's work to study why people do in fact develop and practice religious beliefs. So I want to clearly state from the outset that it is not my intention to cause mental anguish or distress to any theist, Christian or otherwise. However, having said that, I've been given the task of arguing against the existence of a Christian God, and this I intend to do quite convincingly. Now, by now it should be quite clear that the defining features of the proposed God I'm to disprove have or will have been described by Joe. The usual attack by theists follows kind of a type of pattern. Let's see if this works. I need to know if this has been connected or not. Thank you, God. We need a tech person to see if that works. Okay. I don't know which computer it's plugged into.
We need
an orange shirt. Get an orange shirt up here. Somebody in an orange shirt.
You shouldn't have chosen William Blake, should you?
Ah. Is that the computer there? Ah. This is nice. Do I get to keep this as a parting gift? Nothing showing up on that screen? How are you guys doing on that screen? You guys are good? No offense to my brothers and sisters in the left, but I'm going to get things going here, and they'll get that going as well. So, the usual attack by theists follows this pattern, basically, of having a naturalized or scientific explanation in some regard. Had I known what the setup was going to be like, I would have used a bigger font. I'm sorry, but Joe, pass out the binoculars, would you? So, there we go. There are explanatory gaps, and we have a God that fills in the gaps, and things are freezing up. Okay. Well, there we go. So essentially, how I see things with religion and the concept of God and whatnot is that, you know, people look out into the world and they see the way things function and they can't explain things in particular ways, and so there are these gaps or what are called lacunae, these kind of holes of explanation, and so sometimes gods are used to fill in that gap for various reasons. And the God we're talking about tonight specifically is a Christian God. We're not talking about Norse or ancient Roman or ancient Greek or Muslim or Hindu. We are talking very specifically about the God that Joe believes in, which is the Christian God. Now, I am not partial in my approach to disproving God. I don't believe in any of the gods of organized religion. So this goes out to all Hindus and Muslims and practicing religious people. It has the same effect. So although tonight I'll be working basically with a Christian God, I think these arguments work equally as well for other types. So, I'm going to discuss a number of factors tonight on the limitations of human knowledge, scriptural contradictions, possibly get into discussing the evolution of religion, looking at scientific knowledge and what's called epistemic responsibility. If we have time, I'll look at inherent tensions in Christian dogma. Again, if there's time, we'll look at moral issues and then the differences between basically secular and Christian values, of which there's considerable commonality between them. So, Joe, I didn't get to do this last time, but I am curious. This is a kind of a creation-evolution continuum, and what you have here is you have basically kind of like young Earth positions, those who believe that the universe and whatnot is like 6,000 years old, and then it shows a continuum of where people of faith will have evolutionary ideas enter into their religious views as well. So it goes from flat Earth people to geocentrists, or those who believe the Earth is the center and the sun goes around, to young Earth creationism, those people who believe the planets and the stars and everything are about 6,000 or so years old. And then there's old Earth creationism. They believe in biblical scriptures, but the universe is really much older, and so on and so forth. And then it goes all the way down to materialistic evolution. How would you put yourself in this chart?
Well, Christians would find themselves anywhere between young Earth creationism right through to theistic evolution.
Right, okay. And how do you place yourself?
What's the relevance? Is this a cross-examination section?
No, I just want to know where I'm at in terms of how I'm to direct my rebuttals. And
sure, yeah. Well, I'm happy to say. I would be a creationist.
Right.
And some would be agnostic about the age of the Earth. My personal conviction is that biblical history is true history.
Okay, so you'd be around the young Earth creationism. Okay. So now we have that cleared up. Good. So what can currently be known about God? As Joe mentioned, I am an agtheist, which is a sufficiently ugly term to bring together atheism and agnosticism. I'm atheistic to all world religions. I don't think any of them have it right, because it just can't be demonstrated. If there were some kind of way in which we could measure the truth of religious belief, then maybe I would be a theist, and maybe we wouldn't be having this debate. We'd just be sitting around sipping tea and agreeing, or going to Mass, or whatever. But because there isn't a reality kind of measuring stick that can measure the various types of religions, I can find fault with every world religion. And so that's why I'm atheistic against, basically, world religions. But I'm an agnostic when it comes to the origin of the universe itself, because I don't know if it was brought into existence as an intentional act or an unintentional act. I tend to live my life without really making any determinations about that, because I don't think any of us can make that determination. None of us knows for sure if the universe was intended. So basically, all religions commit errors in human reasoning, and they lead me to hold a position that they're, you know, untenable at least, and pretty much impossible at best. So, what can we say about the origins of the universe, you know? I see a disjunct of plausibility. This is just logical notation. UI means the universe was intended, V means or, and this means basically not intended. So it really comes down to that, right? It's that simple. Either the universe was intended to come into existence, or it wasn't. And I can't really say which was the case. I have no idea. I'm fully prepared to believe that there was no intentionality, and the universe simply came into existence not 6,000 years ago, but about 13.7 billion years ago. On that, Joe and I really disagree. Okay? And I guess that's okay, but how I see things developing from this is there's a certain level of ignorance. We don't know for sure whether the universe was intended or not. So I just basically, I suspend judgment. I say, okay, what am I going to do? Well, I can't figure it out. Well, I'm not going to let it bother me then. And I just kind of bracket it and I put it off to the side. So I have no direct evidence. So basically, I'm going to worry about issues that are much more important to my life and my fellow humans and whatnot. I'm going to do many of the types of things that Joe does in terms of trying to help others and be compassionate and that sort of thing, which are built into both his philosophy of life and Mr. Corin's philosophy of life. So there's overlap, and I think we can all agree that it's good to help others and it's good to be charitable and so on and so forth. I just do it without all the extra baggage of trying to have my ideas fit into a definition of a god. I just think helping people is good in and of itself. I don't need a big holy hand patting me on the back. I just think it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Now, if it turns out that the universe was unintended and there is no god, then the universe is accidental. And, well, essentially, that means we are all accidents. But what wondrous accidents we are to be able to come around and to have this dialogue, this debate tonight. Right? So the universe would be without meaning. And Joe says, well, that's irrational. That's a horrible thing, a universe without meaning. Let's just do a thought experiment for a second. Let's imagine, John Lennon, let's imagine that the universe has no meaning, and that we are accidental. Now ask yourself this, what does it change? You're still here? You still love your fellow man? You still care about your family? You still care about the environment, the rest of the world, your schooling? It doesn't change a thing, because we all still gotta struggle through life no matter what, whether there is ultimate meaning or there isn't. So we're still here, we're in this together, let's figure out how we're going to get along. I think that's the most important thing, because otherwise we're going to try to fit our ideas into a particular type of perspective that says, I'm right, and those of you who don't agree with me, you're kind of wrong. I love you and all, but you're burning in hell forever and all time. So there's a bit of a problem sometimes, right? And it can be frightening. This can be a very frightening realization. Because people want meaning. They want purpose. I think it is an instinct. I think it is from biology. I really do believe we have developed consciousness and the ability to question who and what we are. And we do look for meaning. And when life doesn't work out very well for us, we want to believe that there's something more. Why? Because it actually makes evolutionary sense. It's going to keep us around a little bit longer to survive and reproduce. So it's actually built into us to desire and strive for meaning. So we're going to create all sorts of things to develop this concept that there is more, or when we fail, don't worry about it, it's going to be okay. I tend to think if there's meaning and purpose, I haven't discovered it yet. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, I just haven't discovered it yet. But let's go on living as best we can, and if it turns out that there's something more in the universe and after we die, do you really think a caring God would not want you to hang out with him for being a good person and not believing in him? Do you really think God would say, hey, you had your chance, you blew it? Right? It doesn't sound fair. That doesn't sound like a great God. So if we're all alone in the universe, then maybe it's essentially impossible for all world religions to have a correct interpretation of reality. This is logic. This is basic logic. Okay? There are over 1,200 different types of religion in the world. Okay? It's impossible for every one of those religious views to describe reality exactly as it is. It's impossible. Just based on some religions believing there are many gods and some religions believing there is only one God. That alone makes it impossible. So we can't just say, oh, everybody's right. Group hug, right? We can't do that. Logic doesn't allow for that. And I don't mean to appear cold and analytic, but if we're going to have a debate tonight with open dialogue, we have to play by the rules. And the rules of logic say, no, it's impossible for all world religions to correctly interpret reality. However, it is quite possible for all world religions to be wrong. Okay? That is a possibility. Joe was saying if we don't have a God in which to base rationality, what we have is basically human-based values. What is wrong with human-based values? My whole life is based on human-based values. And when we sit down, Michael and Joe and I, and we discuss what's valuable in your life, I don't think we would find it unusual that our values are quite similar and that we will overlap in the things we find valuable in life. I just find them valuable without a God, that's all. You gentlemen have varying beliefs. You have a more Protestant concept of a God, and you have more Catholic concept of a God. But many of the values in religion, and don't think I'm down on religion. Religion has done a lot of good in the world. There's no question about it. And has promoted a lot of harmony in the world. But that's because the people inherently are good. And it's really the people that are good. I'm not sure if it's the religion. It gives them something to care for, and it gives them a reason to be good. But I think those people are generally going to be good people anyhow. And it's only a few of the members of certain religions around the world that give everyone else a bad name. And that's unfortunate. And those are the ones we obviously have to stand up to and say, no, once your beliefs generate harm to others, I can't buy into tolerating your religion anymore. I'm going to stand up to you, and I'm going to say, no, I'm not accepting this. You have every right to believe what you want to believe. But once it starts to generate harm to humanity, other species on this planet, somebody has to step up and say, wait a minute, have you thought this through carefully? Because what you're doing is harming others. So I have no problem whatsoever with religious belief. My extended family are Roman Catholic. When they come over to my house for Sunday dinner,
I welcome them to say grace. I mean, I have no problem with that. It doesn't offend me. My sister's not particularly thrilled that there's a portrait of Henry Morgenthaler on the wall. But other than that, Henry supported. So we get along, and we get along with this kind of plurality of views. I think it's epistemically responsible to do the right thing, to basically believe in certain things. In the case of
the universe being intended or not, I suspend judgment. I just think that's the epistemically responsible thing to do. I can't make any determination one way or the other, so I'm just going to suspend judgment. You don't have to do that. If you think that sounds like a good idea and you want to do that, that's fine. But I'm not going to tell you, this is what I believe it or get out kind of thing. That's entirely up to you. That's your call. Okay? Same with religious belief. The majority of religious beliefs, of course, are based on faith. They're not based on knowledge. As much as Joe would like to say, and as much as Michael would like to say, I know God exists, they can't say that. They can say, I believe very strongly in my faith, right? I have faith in my God. But they can't say, I know God exists like I know I am now existing. They can say they feel it in their heart, or Jesus speaks to them, or whatever. They can say all that, but why can't I feel it, right? So, and I would like to be able to be certain that there is a particular God. I think that would be an interesting world if we all knew for sure that a particular type of God existed. I mean, everybody on this planet had unequivocal evidence that God existed. What a different world that would be, right? Because then we would have just one particular book. There's the rules. This is what the guy up in the sky told us to do. So this is what we do. And that's all there is to it. But there isn't. There is no particular book of truth. There are many books that claim to have the truth, but there are so many different ones. How on this planet are we going to be able to determine which one of them is actually the truth? And we can't. So, many people believe faith is very powerful. It's a motivator. It can move mountains, right? But it doesn't move mountains, right? Science, technology, heavy machinery and explosives do. That's what moves mountains. If you want the mountain moved, you roll up your sleeves and you get to work, right? Now, there are various tensions, obviously, with religious belief. And some of you who are theistic, who believe in a particular type of God, may at some point in your lives face what's known as a religious tension or a crisis of faith, where something happens to you where you're going to try to justify it in some way. In other words, how could a God allow this to happen? And some of you will use your faith to see you through difficult times. And that can be a benefit, right? It's almost like metaphysical Prozac, right? It's kind of like, it's all right, I'll pop a Bible pill or a Quran pill or a Upanishads pill, and I'm feeling pretty good, you know? And if it helps you and it makes you a better person, and you don't break into my house to steal my TV to support your crack habit, I'm happy. I'm really, really happy. You know, that faith that you have is making you a good citizen, that we can get along together and share common values, right? Now, what happens with religions is they take the idea of the universe being intended and they add up entities beyond necessity. All religions commit the fallacy of going beyond and violating what's known as Occam's razor. William of Ockham, as Joe will know, basically said, the simpler idea is probably the one that should be accepted. Parsimony and simplicity are pretty good features for understanding ideas about the world. And what religions do is they make things very, very, very complicated. They go way past necessity. And so they string together a number of what are called conjuncts. Do you remember conjunction, junction? I know some of you are too young, but some of the oldies closer to my age will remember conjunction, junction, right? And, but, and, or, right? I still remember them because of that cartoon. The conjuncts look like this. So what happens with a theist is instead of just suspending judgment on UI or not UI, that the universe was intended or not intended, the choice is that, yep, the universe is intended. Okay, fine, you believe the universe was intended. All right. And we're going to call that intender God. Okay, you're going to call this intender God. What else? Well, God equals X1, X2, X3 to XM. And all of these are conjuncts. These things are basically strings of qualities and attributes, commands, descriptions, so on and so forth. And what happens is they get multiplied way beyond necessity. God created the earth in 6 days, and then he did that, and then man, and then woman, and then from the rib, no, not from the rib, from here, from wherever, and then don't eat from the tree, you ate from the tree, get out of my garden, and all of this happens. And, okay, you screwed up, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a part of me, I'm going to make it human, it's going to go down, it's going to die, so that you guys are forgiven, and then you can come on back into heaven. And are we cool? Is everything good? Right. So, when you start to add up entities beyond necessity, guys like me start to drool. Because I start to see all kinds of logical fallacies, and I see a lot of contradictions. And if you really want to have a meaningful dialogue, if you really, really want to have a meaningful debate, it's go time, you know? DiCarlo versus Boot. We got to put the gloves on, and we got to go after it. Now, in terms of defining a God with all of these various attributes and commands, what happens is when you look through the scriptures, you're going to see an awful lot of contradictions. And there are dozens of them. And I'm just going to mention a few and whip through these fairly quick, right? God is good to all or just a few. Well, the Lord is good to all and his tender mercies are over all his works, right? And I will dash them one against another, even the fathers and the sons, together, said the Lord. I will not pity the fool, nor spare, nor have mercy, but destroy them. So a vengeful, Old Testament kind of wrathful type of God. War or peace, right? Well, the Bible says a number of different things on war or peace, right? So, what do we have here? In Exodus, we have the Lord is a man of war, the Lord is his name, right? Well, later on in Romans, now the God of peace be with you all, amen, right? Is Jesus equal to or lesser than? And what we have here is basically, I and my Father are one. And then, no, ye have heard now, I say unto you, I go away and come unto you, if ye love me, would rejoice, because I said, I go unto the Father, for my Father is greater than I. So, you know, can God be seen? Well, some say yes, depending on which part of the Bible we look at, that he can be seen. I will take away my hand, and so on and so forth. For I have seen God face to face in my life. No, God cannot be seen. No man has seen God at any time, and so on and so forth. So, There's quite a few scriptural contradictions that we find in the Bible. Cruel, unmerciful, destructive, ferocious, kind, merciful, good, right? The Lord is good to all. I will not pity nor spare. So, you know, I'm just going to whip through these contradictions fairly quickly. On the power of God, with all things are possible. The Lord, basically, you know, drove out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. Well, how is this possible? Why couldn't God do that, right? So, you know, there are a number of different scriptural contradictions on incest. Cursed be he that lieth with his sister, and if man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, it is a wicked thing. What was God's reaction to Abraham, who married his sister, right, his father's daughter? God said unto Abraham, well, as for Sarah, thy wife, I bless her and give thee a son also of her. God is tired and rests. God is everywhere present, knows all things. God is everywhere present, neither sees nor all, right? God is never tired. So he's omnipresent. No, he's not omnipresent. He's tired. No, he's not tired. And I'm not making these up. I mean, you can look these up. I mean, they're in the book. God is all-powerful, right? God is not all-powerful, right? God is the author of evil. God is not the author of evil. So, I mean, which is it, right? God accepts human sacrifices, right? God forbids human sacrifice, right? Because of a man's wickedness, God destroys him because of man's wickedness. God will not destroy him. And this is in Genesis, very close together. So, you know, there is but one God. There is a plurality of gods, right? And Joe, you believe in the Trinity?
Yes, I do.
Yes, yeah, so the Trinity, for those of you who don't know, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit? Yes.
Correct.
So a three-part God, which is interesting, right? Because a God made up of three parts. The Son, Jesus, was the human part made flesh that went down and died on the cross for our sins, right? Yes. Give it up for Jesus. Now, many of you will not know this, but something rather remarkable happens in the Old Testament, but you've got to read the book fairly carefully to be able to see the types of contradictions and inconsistencies that occur just in the Old Testament with Moses alone. So, in terms of homicide and murder and genocide, right, you shall not kill as a divine command. Now, Moses leads, basically after he comes down from the mount and he has the Ten Commandments, he leads the Hebrews on a blood-soaked trek to the Promised Land. I don't know if you guys realize this or not. And it's not necessarily, you know, Charlton Heston with the NRA doing this kind of thing. It's, you know, he basically destroyed every city, man, woman, children. They left none remaining. This is one of the things that basically Moses says to his generals after they had just pummeled a city. He said, now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones and kill every woman who has known man by lying with him. But all the young girls who have not known man by lying with them, nah, keep alive for yourselves. Yes, look it up. So, Moses is basically saying, you're getting your virgins early. Right? And it's there, and you can see why it's there. We're talking about tribal warfare. We're talking about the chosen people. Once you are considered chosen, anybody who's not a member of your club, you can do whatever you want to. Why? Because it's justified. And there's no higher justification than the supposed existence of a supreme being. So I can kill in the name of any god I want to because I'm doing his work now. Do I think the orange shirts here want to kill in the name of God? No, I hope not, right? Because I always thought the central idea behind Christianity was love, and I still believe that, and I think that's a great message, but it can be abused, and, you know, we're here tonight to hear both sides of the story, and I'm going to give you some of the criticisms that I have. So, obviously, I'm giving you some Old Testament contradictions and whatnot, but I do think the central idea of Christianity as love is a great one. I just think people abuse their power sometimes. It's the middlemen who use religion as a power to be able to manipulate and coerce people within societies. Those are the ones who give religions a bad name, right? Those are the ones we have to spot and we have to call out, right? And call them as what they are, which are hypocrites. How am I doing on time? What's that? Really? It's just flown by. Okay. So. So, essentially, I'll close off with some of my overall points, and that is, you have the ability to be rational. You have the ability to think for yourselves. We can get together and we can decide what's best for all, purely based on human principles and values that are equal and fair and just. And those, I think, should keep us in good stead throughout the rest of our lives and for generations to come. Thank you.
Person to respond, and then we'll break after that. So 10 minutes, obviously. Joe Boot, you to go. I really like Christopher as a person, and appreciate the humor with which he seeks to conduct the debate, the discussion tonight. But I do have to say that we've been treated to 20 minutes of mocking the Bible without understanding it. I'm very happy to come back and do another debate on the nature of the Bible. And I'd be equally happy to come back and deal with the 50 different texts you dealt with there. If you want to do a Bible study, that's great. We'll do that. The question we're asking tonight is, does God exist? Not does Christopher de Carlo like God, not does whether he likes Moses, not whether he thinks there are contradictions in the text, but does God exist? What Chris has done, and I say I respect him as a friend, has totally sidestepped the challenge tonight. I offered a transcendental challenge. How do you make sense of rationality? How do you ground it? Morality, logic, truth, without an appeal to God, in a universe of brute factuality, in a universe where chance is thrown out of the womb of chaos, totally unrelated facts. Just imagine you live in the Sahara Desert right now, and you're made of sand. And your environment is sand. And it's all swirling around in a storm. That is the atheistic picture of the world. There is no relationship between the facts. There is no basis for differentiation between one thing or another. Christopher's assertions about, well, we can just, you know, come together and collectively decide what's nice and what's good. These are arbitrary statements. That's not an argument. Anybody can stand up and say, let's all get together and say, you know, well, this will be rational and that will be rational. That's not an argument, friends. An argument is offering some kind of logical coherence in terms of how we can have this debate tonight, and that debate makes sense because the universe is rational and we can appeal to logic. What are the preconditions of a debate? Well, I heard Christopher refer several times to laws of thought, laws of logic. What are laws of logic? Well, if they're merely consensual, that is, if we're just going to get together and say, hey, well, let's decide what's rational. Let's have some laws. Well, what if your laws disagree with my laws? And the Nazis' laws disagree with Stalin's laws? And Mao's laws disagree with European laws? Whose laws are right? What is the criterion? What's the basis for judgment? Oh, because we feel gooey and we think, well, that's good and that's not good? That isn't an argument. That is just an arbitrary assertion. I did not offer you a God of the gaps. I said that God is a necessary precondition. He is a necessary foundation for the intelligibility of human experience. Not that he fills gaps. Most religions, by the way,
do not believe in God. It's all very well to talk about other religions and other scriptures. First of all, only biblical faith, and I would include in that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, those that hold to a theistic conception, actually believe in a personal God. All the other religions and their scriptures, which Westerners have called scriptures, are the ethical teachings of philosophers. They do not claim to be revelation from a personal God for the very good reason that they believe in an impersonal, ineffable, unknowable principle. In Buddhism, you are absorbed into the ultimate oneness of the universe where the self is annihilated. That's not God. Buddhism is atheistic. What is the relevance of the creation-evolution question? Well, I do think evolution is an important question, but that wasn't the question tonight. There are Christians who hold to various forms of theistic evolution. True, I don't happen to agree with that perspective, but the issue is, rightly identified, is this a designed, planned, intentioned universe? He wants to find fault with religions. He says there are errors in human reasoning, things that are impossible. Well, on what basis are they impossible? I mean, if my mind is an electrochemical event, it's a byproduct, an epiphenomenon of a physical process, you can't make a judgment tonight between what is impossible and what's not possible. Your brain is a weed growing in the garden, and so is mine. You reach your conclusions, I reach mine. It's as simple as that. There is no debate to be had because there's no transcendent criterion for truth because there's no God. There's no structure. Christopher dogmatically refuses to ask the question of origins, and of course he must, or I'll just suspend judgment. Suspending of judgment is a metaphysical position. That's dogmatic. We can't avoid dogmatism. We can't avoid a metaphysic. We have to ask the question of origins, because the question of origins defines whether this universe is rational, logical, structured, moral, and everything else. Age of the universe is just a red herring because he thinks that identifying me as a creationist will make me look bad in your eyes. Maybe he's right, but that doesn't answer the question whether God exists, how old the universe is. He claims that we've got this authoritative basis for physics. Leon Lederman, the Nobel laureate, said, "To believe things that cannot be proved is the essence of physics." I cited Ernst Mach, who said, didn't even believe in atoms. We don't have an established cosmology. If you read New Scientist just a few years ago, you could have read an article called Bucking the Big Bang. Scientists all over the world were offering different models for the universe. He says we agree about morality and goodness. Well, actually we do. There are many issues. We might say, well, this is good, or this, we don't believe in abusing children or murder. But I've got a basis for believing that. It's God and the Ten Commandments. Christopher doesn't. It's a preference. It's a personal taste issue. Maybe if he has a bad experience in a year's time, he may change his mind on some of those ethical parameters. How do we ground goodness? Is goodness is evil and good objective realities? Is this definitely wrong and this definitely right? Or not? He says, imagine the universe is irrational. What's changed? Who cares? Well, thank you, Christopher. You've made my point exactly. He has acknowledged the point that we can only, without God, imagine the universe has meaning, and that's exactly my point tonight. Is that all you can do is imagine a morality, imagine a meaning, imagine a truth, and imagine that debate can be had, because there is no debate to be had tonight based on Christopher's worldview. He's borrowing from my worldview to have a debate. He's saying there is rationality, there's logic, there's structure, there's morality. But he doesn't want to ask the question, how are those things grounded or founded? He's totally sidestepped the challenge. He says we're biologically programmed to search for meaning. Well, why? Some people's meaning is to eat their neighbor. The Christians' meaning is to love their neighbor. Which is it? Which is true? If they're culturally conditioned, is it right to eat your neighbor? If the objective of life is to pass on your genetic material, then why not copulate with as many people as possible? Why not commit rape and so on and so forth? Because you're passing on more effectively your DNA than others. He has totally acknowledged my point tonight.
that this universe is what the existentialists say it is without God. We are confronted with an irrational surge, and all we can do is say, let's pretend that goodness and truth are real things. Because Chris doesn't he doesn't know God, or doesn't believe he's not exactly compelled by all the evidences. That wasn't really the question tonight. This is pure subjectivism and pure relativism. He says, I can't say for sure that God exists. I'm saying that tonight I can only have this debate or say anything rational if God does exist. That's the choice. This is either sound and fury signifying nothing, as Shakespeare put it, or God exists and this is a rational discussion where you can judge the valid from the invalid. Darwin himself acknowledged, how can we possibly trust our minds if we've arisen simply through blind chemical processes? He says, Occam's razor asks, which is the simplest? Well, I'll ask you, what's the simplest? That something came from nothing? That molecules and atoms arranged themselves into this design, this unity and diversity, this order and this structure? He says there's contradictions in the Bible, war and peace, the greater one and the lesser one. I can't even go into all of those. I can't possibly deal with that in 10 minutes. I'm happy to host another debate here and deal with all of those texts. Moses did command through the voice of God, you shall not kill. That is, you shall not murder. You can only take life on the basis of God's commandment. And in the Mosaic law, that included the execution of murderers. It wasn't a blanket statement. God, as the creator, sustainer, and governor of all things, has the right to judge people. And in those texts that were referred to, God was judging a people called the Canaanites, who were child-sacrificing pagans, and God waited 400 years while the children of Israel were in Egypt. And he says, my patience has now run out, and when the people went into the promised land, they dealt with those pagan nations as a basis of God's justice.
Thank you. Michael of Pompous Fool says what? Yeah. You're a pompous fool, ladies and gentlemen. Ah, I can hurl ad hominems as well. I know, it's okay. We'll talk about it at the break. We'll talk about it at the break. Isn't it easy to hurl ad hominems, eh? Joe, you said suspending judgment is a metaphysical position. Because it counters your particular metaphysical position. I think my position is a metaphysical position just like the off button is a channel. Right? It's not. It doesn't enter into that same realm that you're describing. And I think that's an unfair tactic. One of the things I would like to ask you is basically the way I define people is a dogmatist is somebody who is unwilling to consider the possibility that they could be wrong. And one of the things I'd like to ask you is whether or not you think any or all of your beliefs in God could be false. Is that a possibility?
Although this debate doesn't include a space for cross-examination, because I would have loved to have asked you a few questions,
right.
I will answer that. I believe that God is the precondition of all rationality.
Okay.
And therefore, to even have a rational discussion tonight, we need to believe in the existence of God. If I could be shown with respect to Christianity that there is something unequivocally contradictory and absurd about my faith, I would be forced to say rationally, I must relinquish my faith.
Okay, so then it is a possibility.
Yes.
Okay, so what we want to do now is we want to think about essentially the idea of the notion of an irrefutable set of beliefs, because when theists get up in the morning and they have certain beliefs about the way the world functions, they generally maintain that that is reality, that is, they're right, that is the way the world functions and whatnot. And if you have evidence that is presented to you that might convince you otherwise, you might be prepared to give up your faith or your belief in various types of gods. But there are some tensions inherent in what I think are inherent in Christian dogma, the idea of omnipresence and revelation, the tension between defining God as all-powerful and all-knowing, the problem of specifying one particular type of God, the tension between human biology and, of course, Christian morality, and the idea that there's tensions between defining Christian God as an all-good, basically omnibenevolent God and the existence of evil in the world. Now, does your God exist? I don't believe so. I don't have good reason to believe that based on the fact that you're quoting from a particular book. You talked about Bible study and whatnot. To me, in just presenting contradictions alone should warrant you to really get up in the morning and consider, okay, how are we going to reconcile these inconsistencies? Why isn't the Bible more consistent in this particular type of way? In the Bible, it talks about Noah using, you know, basically cubits and God speaking to him through a burning bush and his staff turning into a snake. Jesus turns water into wine, loaves to fishes. He walks on water. He heals the sick. But if God really is this powerful, why in the Bible are the examples always time relative? Right? Like, think about it. Why wouldn't God give Noah the metric system? Right? It would have made things so much easier in getting this boat put together. Right? Moses, no staff turning in it. Give him a Sherman tank or an ICBM. Just, you want to smoke your enemies? That's how you do it. Right? What about more, you know, basically efficient and omnipresent, you know, simultaneity? So, basically, the idea of, you know, in Jewish traditions and in Muslim traditions of not eating pork, I think it's just smart if you live in a desert climate, right? Because there's parasites. You don't want trichinosis. Don't eat pig. That's a great idea. Let's not do that, right? And the idea of a new Messiah. Winston, is there a second coming? Because many different Christian faiths have told me, he's coming. He's going to be here pretty soon. But I don't have any evidence in this. Many members of the Bush administration believe that Armageddon was pretty much just around the corner. If you listen carefully enough, you can hear the four horsemen of the apocalypse. But I've not heard them yet. So, why aren't there modern miracles? You know, essentially, why are we, you know, looking at guys like David Blaine and Chris Angel doing these types of amazing demonstrations of magic that are very, very, very impressive? But why aren't there modern miracles today? Right? Instead, what we're seeing in God's revealed miracles are things like, you know, oil spots that look like Jesus, right? You get wood grains, and you get chocolate figures, and you get grilled cheese sandwiches of the Virgin Mary, you know. You want a real miracle? Grow a limb on an amputated child's arm. You do that for me, I'll convert tonight. Okay? But of course, that's what we hope stem cell research will someday do. And that's humans doing that. Not God. The problem of free will has often bothered me. If your God, Joe, is defined as being very powerful and very intelligent, knows all, can do anything, okay, there are some certain tensions that arise, right? I don't think we possess free will. If your God exists, I don't think any of us really have free will, right? Because apparently if we choose correctly, we get rewarded, right? We go to heaven. And if we choose incorrectly, well, it doesn't look so good for some of us. Now, I don't know what's going to happen to my Muslim sisters in the front row here. After you ladies die, perhaps according to Mr. Boot, you're on a highway to hell. Yeah, and that's unfortunate, because I'm sure you're good people, right? And I'm sure you deserve everlasting reward and a type of heaven. Right? But I don't know I don't know if this club allows you guys in. I'm not sure. Right? So. Now, I'm going to finish up with an Android example, okay? I'm going to assume Joe and many people here who have Christian faith believe in the parable or the idea or the myth of Adam and Eve, that all of us came from two people created by a God 6,000 years ago. So God creates a man and then creates a woman and basically says, You can do anything you want in this garden, just don't eat from the apple or the fruit of the tree of knowledge. That's forbidden. And of course, eventually Satan comes along in the form of a snake, convinces Eve to basically coerce Adam to eat from this. God finds out, and he loses it, and they are banished forever and for all time. Their eyes are open, they can now see that they're nude, and that's not a good thing, and they've got to cover themselves up. And so I'm going to give you an example of a couple of androids that I have built in my basement in my spare time. And they're called Hannah and Steve. This is about as close to Adam and Eve as I could get. Now, basically, these two androids have been developed by me, and I know exactly how they're going to behave at every moment of every day, just as God would have known of Adam and Eve many years before they were ever brought into existence. So, I say to my androids, you can do whatever you like, but do not eat the mangoes from my mango tree. If you do, I will torture you for the rest of your lives. But they cannot choose to abstain from eating the mangoes because I made them, and I know they're going to eat the mangoes. Basically, what I'm asking here is, why would the God of the Bible intentionally create beings like Adam and Eve and millions of others when he knew they were going to fail? Does this not make God somewhat sadistic? Because he brings beings into the world knowing they're going to fail in order to punish them. Just as all of you who are of varying faith, who are going to choose to believe in something other than him, why did he allow you to be brought into the world, knowing millions of years before your existence what you were going to choose every second of every day? And your choices will condemn you forever and for all time. Doesn't sound like the kind of God I want to have in my world. Am I good? Okay, thanks.
Says atheist question, 1 minute. So, I mean, you can take a little bit longer, try to keep it to 1 minute, a question rather than a statement if you could. So, atheist number one, ask your question, please. Atheist number one is wearing a white hoodie and blue jeans.
Is regarding the world and is there a choice? Because Christopher said there is no choice in a predestined world where God knows everything and it's all predetermined. But my question is, because Christopher DiCarlo also said that we're born inherently good, that people are good, and we come in here into the world good. So if we come in here in this pre-existing state, is there any choice in that world? Is there any choice in a world that is, that we are born into inherently good? Do we have a choice there?
Did you hear the question okay? Yeah? Okay. You got the question?
Yeah. So, I'm to respond. Is there any...
You have 1 minute to answer, and then Joe will respond
for
1 minute.
And the question, as I'm to understand, is there any inherent good? Oh, is there any choice? Oh, I see. Yes. Right. Yeah, sure. I mean, there's certainly the illusion of choice. I don't know if we ultimately are so determined that we can't even choose the type of clothes we want to wear because there are so many causal factors influencing us. In terms of normative choice, how I should behave towards others, I would say there's only choice insofar as my brain is working properly. And if it's not, I can do all kinds of nasty things, and no God, nowhere is going to fix what's going on in my brain. So it really comes down to neural processes. Yeah.
For both speakers, If you can speak into the mic, I know the tendency to look there, but these are fairly omnidirectional, so if we can just speak into the mic. Joe, you have 1 minute to respond.
Yeah, I'm not in the least bit surprised that Chris answered that in his worldview there's not ultimately any free choice. The atheist position ultimately must be biochemical and atomic determinism. The difference between the Christianity, the knowledge, the foreknowledge of God and his purpose is that one is personal, in which God provides for creatures who are a secondary cause to make meaningful choices. In atheistic thought, you have ultimately, you're a product of your genes. As Dawkins has eloquently put it, you're dancing to your DNA. Now, Christopher says there that the question is only, as it comes to acting towards other people, is your brain working properly? Well, here we come back to the critical question again. On what basis, what criterion do we judge what is the proper function of a brain? After all, in an atheistic worldview, there is no mind as such, there is only brain. The idea of mind is immaterial, spiritual. So there is brain. So what is the criterion for judging between what is a valid functioning of a brain and what is an invalid functioning of a brain? It's just two types of functioning. Okay. There is no basis, no transcendent basis for judging validity.
Thank you very much. Second question, please.
Okay, this is my question. In the world of the Matrix, in the womb of your mother, did your body's inability to recognize your mother as a creator disprove her existence?
Michael? If the speakers want to repeat the question, by the way, that's entirely acceptable. I won't include that in a minute.
Right. So, in the world of the Matrix, in the womb of your mother, did your body's inability to recognize your mother as your creator disprove her existence? Well, no. I hope not, because otherwise, like the Buckley's commercial, I might just go out of existence, right? So no, I would answer, of course not. When you're basically born, I'm obviously an evolutionist, and I believe in biological reproduction, and so even though we can imagine matrix scenarios and compare them, the pods, to be similar to your mother's womb, basically, no, I would say it would not lead me to disprove her existence, that things outside of your mind actually do exist, even though it's very difficult to prove these things with any kind of certainty. I go along with the appearances.
Thank you.
Michael, I didn't fully hear the question. I'm so sorry. Something about the Matrix and Neo.
He's Canadian. Be very, very careful.
It's getting very tense, isn't it?
Ultimately, certainly, what we believe about in this hypothetical world, I would agree that it doesn't disprove the issue of the creator. I think there are, very interestingly, when we come to a subject like the existence of God, there are a lot of psychological things going on as well. It's not just about rationality. We have deeply personal, cherished beliefs, and often the atheist has reasons for they're not wanting to be a father figure. It's interesting, the historian John Coster did a study of famous atheists and their difficult or non-existent relationship with their fathers. In fact, Nietzsche, Freud, Huxley, Darwin, Ingersoll, Hitler all had what he described as atheist syndrome. Huxley and Freud, he said, were son victims revealing their symptoms by railing against Christianity. Huxley himself called his hate crib biting. So certainly there are psychological reasons why we might want to, and emotional reasons why we might want to deny the existence of God as our creator. It isn't simply an issue of rationality.
Okay. Third question, please.
question is, how can we justify the prophecies that are prophesied in the Torah and the Bible and the Quran that actually happen in today's world? For example, the Noble Quran states, as we know, the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, the Noble Quran states, and it talks about the embryo, which is the baby in its mother's stomach. It states exactly the stages that they go through, from basically from its inception to having a bone and a flesh and so on. How could a man 1,400 years ago know of the concept of the embryo when they didn't have any science? And today there are universities.
Okay, I think the question was
yeah. Well, to answer that, basically, what was this, 1,400 years ago?
1,400, yeah.
How long?
1,400.
4,000?
1,000.
Yeah, 1,400 years ago. Very simple. I mean, you know, there were all kinds of miscarriages. I mean, the child mortality rate was extremely high back then. People would have seen an awful lot of spontaneously aborted fetuses and would have just been able to make that connection. You know, prophecies. I can prophesize about all kinds of stuff. Why aren't we listening to Nostradamus and people like that? I mean, prophecies are so inherently vague. You know, I could prophesize now, you know, that a great king will die at some point in the future and whatnot, or, you know, that sort of thing. And it might come true, it might not. And if it does somewhere in the world, I'm a great prophet.
Yeah, but you're not answering my question.
Well, do you want to take a...
Well, I did answer your question. How do they know saturation stages?
May I just ask, because you're an atheist, are you?
No.
So I'm... To the organizers, this is meant to be three atheist questions. It's not really fair to Dr. DiCarlo with Sir. But anyway, thank you for the question. Atheists and non-atheists, you may sit down. Thank you very much. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's all right.
And Joe, you have 1 minute to answer that question.
Well, the issue of prophecy is, of course, a very interesting one. In the Old Testament, there are over 300 prophecies concerning the Messiah. There are 109 distinct, individual, different prophecies in the Old Testament. If you read the book of Daniel, for example, you will find that long before these occurrences took place, Daniel prophesied in minute detail, so minute that skeptics have said it must have been written after the event, about the rise and fall of various empires, including the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, and indeed the coming of Christ and his kingdom. So biblical prophecy is important to Christians. Isaiah 53 prophesies the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ. These are not vague. These are not Nostradamus rhyming quatrains. There are detailed, explicit, and specific prophecies that have meant skeptics have had to try and insist that they can't possibly have been written before the event, which may be the only recourse to account for them. Now, you can obviously only have prophecy if you have a God who knows the end from the beginning and who in his providence governs history. And that's the whole point of what we said tonight.
And now we have three questions from the theist position. Theist number one. If humans require God to have rationality and truth, how can God have rationality without a God above him?
Okay, good question. Well, God, by definition, is a necessary being. By the very characterization of who God is, he's eternal, he's omniscient, he's omnipresent, he's omnipotent, and it is the nature of rationality. The reason for the Christian that the universe itself and that human beings are rational is because God has created a rational universe. Now, the basis for rationality in God requires no recourse to another God. I mean, at the end of the day, then the being that created this God would actually be the true God. So all you're doing is removing the true God to one further back. It's just simply a step back. You're not disproving theism. The Christian position and the theistic position has always been that God, by definition, is a necessary being, and it's his exhaustive rationality of his own being, actually in the Trinitarian concept of God in particular, that we can actually have logic, rationality, differentiation, and so forth. We do not require recourse to another absolute, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent God to ground
the rationality of the God of Scripture.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is the perennial question that a lot of kids will ask, actually, when they're growing up, right? Who or what created God, right? Why is God self-sufficient? Why is God necessary and whatnot? And I think it's an excellent question to ask at any point in our lives. What determines the necessity of a God? Why should the God have to exist? Why couldn't the universe itself be self-sufficient and generating basically everything that is in it? Why does there have to be an intelligent prime mover that started everything else? I can live in a world just as easily imagining that the universe began totally by accident and spat everything out, and it's incredibly immense. Think about this for a second. Why is the universe so big? And we're the best thing that God created? Are you kidding me?
Maybe Klingons, Christopher.
Now, Klingons, I'm with you there.
Speak for yourself, by the way.
Romulan lover.
Second question, please.
Racist.
So, Joe, the transcendental argument that you argued for, it suggests this a divine source of knowledge, but how do you make the leap from this vague God to Jesus Christ, Christianity, and all of its particulars? And I guess for Christopher, do you think he's justified in making this huge leap?
1 minute, Joe. It's difficult to answer in 1 minute, but it's a great question, and one I'd love to talk to you about further afterwards if we get an opportunity. Here the Christian goes to the heart of the Christian apologetic, which is not an embarrassment to us, but the Trinity, the doctrine of the Trinity is not a logical contradiction. It does not assert, contrary to Dr. DiCarlo's statement, that God is three and one. Rather, he's three in one. That is, the being of God, God's being, is tripersonal. One God, three persons. And in order to have a rational universe, this is an ancient question in philosophy, the question of the one and the many. Is the universe ultimately a unity, or is it ultimate diversity? One gives you pantheism, the other gives you a naturalistic perspective. And the one, the unity, annihilates the diversity, or the diversity annihilates the unity. When only in the Trinitarian concept of God do you have unity and diversity in the cause, and therefore unity and diversity in effect. It's the basis for knowledge. If God is a monad, a singularity, how could he possibly know anything? You've got to have subject-object relation. How could God love anything before he created the world? You need subject-object relation. So it's the Trinity that actually is the heart of the Christian apologetic.
Is it Joe? But notice what Joe just did. I mean, you just said, how can you go from a vague concept of a God to a very specific one about a Krishna, okay? And he's making these enormous leaps of faith based on an antiquated book that has ideas written by people about people that may never have done any of the things that were in that particular book. The problem, of course, again, with organized religion, especially theism in general, is they multiply entities far past necessity. There's just way too many descriptions about who God is, what he does, and all that sort of thing. And what happens is, you're best to be safe and keep it vague. So if you keep God kind of vague and nebulous, you won't make as many logical fallacies and errors in reasoning. But once you start to make things fairly specific, not only does it separate you from other religious beliefs, right? Sorry, my Muslim sisters, but you're not in the club, right? And what happens is, you divide yourself off from the rest of humanity. So some of your ideas may be actually very good ideas, but they're very divisive as well, and I think that's an inherent danger in defining a particular God in that way.
Okay. The last question of the evening, it better be a good one.
First of all, let's set the record straight that I'm a de facto atheist, not a theist. I'd like to ask you about the ancient mythological god Osiris. Things like he was born on December 25th, born of a virgin, healed the crippled, the blind, known as the way, the truth, and the light, died, rose again 3 days later. How do you respond to allegations that your god is a fairy tale character from a myth written 1,200 years before his supposed existence?
Well, first, the Egyptian worldview is not theistic. It doesn't believe in an ultimately personal god. In fact, for them, pharaohs were a representation of the divine. So mythological stories about Osiris and so forth are just that, mythological stories. You don't read four eyewitness accounts of the death and resurrection of Osiris. You do read four eyewitness accounts of the death, birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is rooted in history. Osiris did not split history in two. Every time you write the date or write the check, you are noting the fact that Jesus Christ, a truly historical figure, split history into two halves. That's how it doesn't matter that we call it BC and BCE anymore. BCE and CE now, because we're trying to expunge Christianity from the calendar. The fact is that's how we date the Western calendar. Osiris, in fact, interesting enough, people like Oxford professors like Lewis and Tolkien saw actually these smatterings of ideas in ancient paganism actually is what, in many respects, led them to believe in the historical authenticity of the true event, the Gospels.
Go on. Okay. I think your question is a very good one. There are many cases throughout history of child king gods being born, all kinds of them that are supposed to come along and save humankind and whatnot. And I imagine that's what Christianity was as well, just another reformulation of a god who's going to come along, help everybody out. Now, by saying that, I'm not saying that there's no good or no value that comes from Christianity. I'm just saying if you take any religion too far, if you take any religion too seriously, I just wonder how much room there is for plurality of views and acceptance of diversity of opinion. That's all, and I think it could lead to trouble in the future.
Thank you. I'd like to ask both of you a question. Why, after spending $300 million, are Tottenham still absolutely awful? Right. Now, there is 5 minutes for each person to conclude, sum up, and we will begin with, says the theist. I think that means you, Joe. You have 5 minutes.
No, I go first and Joe goes
first.
We decided, since he
would go
first.
Oh, you changed it around?
You would go first.
No,
right?
Fair enough.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah.
I think we should fight.
Yeah. You know, I was actually going to suggest that, and I don't know if Joe was up for that, but I would rather not have closing remarks. I'd rather Joe and I just go at it. Wouldn't you like that?
Did you say you and Joe go at it? Don't get homophobic on me, Michael. You know, much as I'd love to say that, if you get that, I haven't seen Joe play soccer, I'm afraid the end would be God does exist. So, 5 minute closing remarks, and you're to start?
Yes. Yes, sure. But, essentially, you know, my closing remarks are basically going to summarize some of the points I've said already and raise a few new ones. And that's basically the idea of, I think, tolerance is a very important factor in any kind of pluralistic society like Canada or anywhere else in the world. The biggest beef I have, of course, with any kind of religion, theistic or otherwise, is that there are an awful lot of inconsistencies. And Joe is, by definition, an apologist, which means somebody who has to say, yeah, okay, yeah, I understand there's some inconsistencies, but if you just look at things this way, it kind of works out. But the problem with that, of course, is that there are just so many inconsistencies. And I wish there weren't. I wish I could have remained a Christian. I wish I could have, you know, somehow held on to my faith. But I just found by the time I was in high school, I was just finding just way too many problems with my Christian beliefs and whatnot. And some of the biggest problems, of course, are the level of tolerance there is versus the amount of harm that could be generated. And, you know, when Joe says he's a young earth creationist, I have to say, you're just wrong. You're just not right. You know, there's no way the universe is 6,000 or 12,000 or 20,000 years old. And in order for me to demonstrate this to you, you have to be accepting of scientific evidence. You have to accept the validity of potassium-argon dating and potassium-lead dating and even, you know, carbon-14 dating if we just want to go to 50,000 years. But even that alone would prove that you were wrong. I don't know why you have the evidence in front of you and choose to be a young Earth creationist. I just,
I just don't get it. You're a bright guy, Joe. I love you. You're a wonderful guy, you know. But that part, really, I have trouble reconciling in my particular view. You ought not to believe that. It is epistemically irresponsible for you to believe that because a singular book says it so. Right? And I'm happy to live in the same world with you. I'm happy to go for, you know, to dinner with you and to be your friend. And we'll get along just fine, provided, of course, that our beliefs don't generate harm towards others. And as long as they're not doing that, I have no problem with us having a plurality of views. But I'm just wondering what you think and what you feel in your heart when you look out into this crowd, knowing that there are Muslims here, knowing that there are Hindus here, knowing that there are gays and lesbians, homosexuals, right? And wondering, in your worldview, is heaven big enough for all of these people? Because if not, then I do think there's a generation of harm, and I do think there is a level of intolerance, and I do think that aspect of faith can be dangerous. And I think that's the type, those are the signs we have to look out for in terms of making determinations about how far our faith is going to go in judging the actions of other individuals. Joe, if I'm a good guy all my life, and nobody's perfect, right? Anybody wants to throw the first stone, you know, go ahead. For those of you who haven't sinned, bring it on. I'm not perfect, you're not perfect. We know Michael's not perfect. So, what I'm saying is, if Michael and you and I and everybody else out here genuinely tries to be good, but they just don't have the particular worldview that you do and your congregation does, do we still get in, you know? Do we still get into the club? Do we get into the big great beyond after we die? Because if we don't, I think there's something seriously flawed with your views. I think they're discriminatory. I think they're homophobic. I think they might even be in some levels racist. Because you are making the defining characteristics of a very exclusive club. And if I don't somehow accept Christ into my life before I die, why should I be damned, or any of these other people of Muslim faith or Hindu faith or Sikh faith, why should they be damned for all time if they are in fact genuinely good people? And so I'm basically going to finish up here with a quote from Robert Ingersoll. He said, "Humanity is the grand religion, and no god can put a man in hell in another world who has made a little heaven in this. God cannot make a man miserable if that man had made somebody else happy. God cannot hate anybody who is capable of loving anybody. Humanity, that word embraces all there is." Thank you.
Professor Boot.
As always with these discussions, it ultimately comes down to just that. Is God just? See, the topic supposedly we were debating tonight is does God exist? But that's not Dr. DiCarlo's problem, you see. He's open on that question. What he doesn't like, he doesn't like God because he doesn't like God's justice, God's definition of justice. That's what comes out and has come out again and again. Issue then is the issue of morality. And as with most skeptics in my experience, the issue is not a lack of evidence to believe in God. It's the desire to live as we want to live without God interfering with our lives in a way that we feel is inappropriate because it limits our freedom in some way or another. Every worldview, whatever you believe, has a point of departure. To call Christianity intolerant is ridiculous. Every worldview that claims truth status has a point of departure. Even Jainism ultimately will say you cannot say that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. So you can, it's impossible to assert any true proposition and be tolerant of the opposite if we're going to say that there is such a thing as truth. Heaven and hell. This again seems to be the issue here. What of heaven and hell? The biblical conception of heaven and hell and of the justice of God is that no man will want to be in the presence of God who doesn't love and worship God. Heaven would be hell to the humanist and the atheist. Hell's their heaven, because it's the perfection in degree of what we want now in life. If our hearts and lives and minds are turned towards God, His righteousness, His truth, His justice, God's presence is heaven to us. It's not heaven to those who would hate God's justice. Those in the... We all go move beyond the grave. Yes, we do. The question is, hell, as biblically defined, is a place where Jesus says there's weeping and gnashing of teeth because people have chosen to be there their own gods, as C.S. Lewis puts it, on the doors. Jesus does not say to any man, you're going to hell. Rather, he says, your will be done. It's those who say, thy will be done, who are in the presence of God, and Jesus says to those who do not want to be there, thy will be done. That's the issue. The issue is justice. Well, on what basis can we have justice in the universe? Christopher has talked a lot about morality and justice and is judging the morality of God. If there's no God, there is only, as Dawkins has put it, blind, pitiless indifference. It's just DNA, it's just molecules, it's just atoms. There is no good, there's no evil, there's no justice, there's no injustice. So there's no good morally complaining to God because morality is not a coherent concept. And that has been my argument this evening. Without God and His Spirit, you only have the material universe. How can a constantly changing, impermanent flux of matter be a basis for unchanging, immaterial laws of thought, rationality, or morality? It is, by definition, impossible. And so only by actually presupposing God can Christopher make a moral complaint against God. As I said before, he wants to borrow from my worldview in order to criticize it. This was not a debate about the age of the earth. If we want to do a debate, a discussion about the age of the universe or whatever, fine, there are other Christians who hold a different view to me. The debate is, does God exist? What is the offense of the Christian position? The offense is that instead of beginning with man and his reason as autonomous and as the ultimate standard, we begin with the being of God and his revelation for the Christian ultimately in Jesus Christ. You see, man's problem, human beings' problem, is that we want to be our own standard for everything. Morality, truth, justice, and everything else. And so we collapse into a relativistic sea. We disappear and deconstruct ourselves into the void of questions with no answers, of ultimate meaninglessness, of the absurd, as the existentialists have put it. The discussion tonight has been about two worldviews, two ways of approaching reality. The most that the non-theist can attest to, can affirm, is the thinking self, the I. That's it. That's all they want to attest to. But they cannot move beyond that, because without God, there's no basis for a correlation between my mind and the world, or a correlation between my mind and your mind. Because there's no pre-ordered structure, pattern, design. There's no design plan. It's irrational, brute factuality. Unbelief leads ultimately to the denial of knowledge because brute facts are impervious to rationality. Our choice is stark. It's a choice between a world of total meaning in God or a world of total meaninglessness, a personal God or an impersonal void. Your choice tonight is not between Joe Boot and Dr. DiCarlo. This is a choice between the autonomous self, the I of DiCarlo, and God. Jesus Christ and Christopher DiCarlo, you take your pick. Jesus has spoken authoritatively, I believe, in his word. He said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. If you really want moral freedom, freedom from guilt, you can know it in the person of Jesus Christ. That I've come, you might have life in all its fullness, and you can know God, I'm telling you that today, in Christ.
Democracy and decency and debate. Thank you very much indeed. Have a safe evening.